Today is November 29th, and I'm at the home of Dr. Bob Johnson in Kodiak. And I'd like to talk to Bob tonight and ask him a few questions about the effect that World War II had on Kodiak Island. Dr. Johnson, would you tell us a little bit about some of the things that have happened to you in your brief life?
It's a loaded question. Some of the things that happened to me in my brief life. I could probably talk all evening about that, but I'm sure you're not interested in that much. So let me say that I was born into a family that had been raised with what I consider a sort of a missionary attitude, which explains largely the reason my father, who was a doctor, gravitated to Kodiak, Alaska, where he saw a need that he felt he could fill. And since, at the time that he gravitated to Alaska, I was 12 and had no visible means of support, I accompanied him along with my mother. And that was in 1938. At that time, Kodiak was a small, sleepy, peaceful fishing village of about 550 people. And there were a lot of things that it didn't have, and I could go into that, but I don't think I will. 1939, the first surveyors arrived, the purpose of taking a look at Woman's Bay in preparation for building a naval station. In 1940, large numbers of construction people arrived, and that naval station began to build, and our community began to grow. That was the start from the Kodiak point of view of a boom that never ceased from that moment until very recently. So in the center of all this boom, I grew up. And graduated from high school while the war was still going on, went south to university and then medical school, and then spent a little time in the United States Merchant Marine during the war, and came back to Kodiak to practice in 1955. I've been in practice, in general practice at first, and then as a board certified family physician since 1955, and I have also been imbued with a little of the missionary spirit, so was engaged in a lot of civic activity all the way along the line. I won't go into that. Briefly, that's it. Currently, I'm still a board certified family physician with a somewhat attenuated practice, working part-time as a consultant for the Kodiak Council on Alcoholism, writing a weekly article of public information on medical subjects in the newspaper, and starting a jazz quartet, and acting in the various productions of all the interested in arts. That about sums it up. I'm married and have four boys, and they're all married. One of them lives here, and the other still make their two of the others still make their living. The other is in Austin. Now what?
Okay, Dr. Johnson, you answered a couple of other questions that I had in mind. You mentioned that before the war there was a sleepy fishing community, and I wonder, because fisheries have a way of changing from one time to another, what kind of fisheries did we have back then, and maybe how many canneries, and did we have any Filipino or Chinese or non-American workers in the canneries at that time? What do you remember about that?
When we arrived at Kodiak in 1938, in the location that is now the coast, this side of the city dock, was Kodiak Fish Company Dock and Cannery. built, I think, in 1912. And it was the only cannery here when we arrived. And it was only processing salmon. So there was a red salmon and a pink salmon fishery, and a silver salmon fishery, and a dog salmon fishery. And that was it. We were a one industry town, and it was a one season industry. Most of the people who lived here fished anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months a year, and the rest of the time they didn't do anything, except for the support industries. So that was it. The next cannery came in 1937. It was a Connelly's cannery and a floating cannery. That was moored down where the ferry dock was now.
Okay.
What else was it you wanted to know?
What about workers? Did that Kadiak cannery, did they have Filipino or Chinese workers similar to the situation where we have today? We have quite a few Filipinos working in the processing plants.
Yes, as you may know, if you read in the history of Kodiak Island, they customarily brought Chinese cannery workers up for the carp fishery, which antedates Kodiak fishery by quite a few years. But in the Kodiak fishery, when we arrived, they were bringing Filipino cannery workers up every summer.
You may have answered this before, Dr. Bob. I know you mentioned that when you talked about your life that you were going to med school. Were you on the island when the war actually broke out, when Pearl Harbor was attacked? And if not, where were you, and how old were you at that time? What do you remember about that?
Pearl Harbor was December of 1941. And in December of 1941, I was a junior at the Kodiak High School, and I was 15 years of age. I remember that fairly well. I remember it showed up in the Kodiak mirror, which may have then still been a mimeograph paper, but I don't remember for sure. It was to begin with. And yeah, I remember it was declared while I was in Kodiak. And prior to that time, we had what we call the Navy kids that had infiltrated the school. They came up with Navy families to man the naval station, or to at least accompany their husbands to man the naval station. And there was a whole influx of military kids that were kind of fun to get to know, as a matter of fact. I was the only Caucasian kid in the school here when I arrived, and for maybe a year or two thereafter. So it was kind of fun to have a bunch of Caucasians come in from outside.
Huh.
Right after the war was declared, though, within 2 weeks, all of those people left. They were evacuated from South Korea, so we were kind of back to square one as far as schools and so on. There was a lot of activity, and a lot more Navy came in, and then the troops started coming in. As a matter of fact, they started coming in before the war, before Pearl Harbor. So it's pretty obvious around these parts that somebody was expecting trouble, and they were preparing for them in advance.
What were some of the wartime projects, either, you know, things that were started before war actually was declared, or begun after war was declared? What are some of the projects that you remember the most?
Are you talking about projects that are a result of the war, having to do with the naval station, or are you talking about projects in town that had to do with the growth that was a secondary result of the influx of military?
Well, let's break that into two parts and talk about the ones related to the war.
Okay, well, a good source for this, by the way, would be Hank Eaton, if you don't have him on your list, because he worked out at the base and he knows a lot about that. A naval station was built with housing for naval personnel, with a fully equipped hospital, and an army camp. A tent city was built on the station in the process of 1 or 2 years, or maybe 3 at the most, starting before Pearl Harbor and extending beyond. how many troops we had in here. I think we had 25,600 people in here at one time. There may have been 50,000 troops at one time. And what they were going to use them for, they had reasons, and I'm not sure that I know them. They didn't do much because there wasn't any ground fighting here or on the ocean. Shame, but I'm sure they didn't know that there wasn't going to be any something like it. The naval station was a headquarters for submarines and for aircraft. And they flew between here and Dutch Harbor and then out to Chamber to, as you would read in the 1,000 Mile War, to bomb Fiskin and recapture it and Adak, which was also captured by the Japanese. A lot of work went on out there. A lot of work went on in town because town swelled by the addition of construction workers for the naval station that was being built, and civil service workers who came in to help operate the base. And the town grew by leaps and bounds from a population of 550 to a population of about 5,000, I think, over 4 years. Part of what went on there, the town became incorporated as a first-class city in 1940, I think. And a lot of businesses were built. I have a list of things that were built, but I'm not sure you want to go into that. Transportation companies, a radio station came in, a phone company that didn't exist. We had no phones. Pacific Northern Airlines, we had no air transportation in here prior to 1940, but in 1940, an airline service between here and Anchorage. And then Alaska Airlines between Seattle and Anchorage started a route to Kodiak that was much easier than the steamships. We came by steamship, and I went back and forth to school by ship, too, as a matter of fact. And that would have been after 42, so the airline service wasn't much. But it did start. We had a post office, of course, when we came. The Kodiak Island, no. Radio station, we had no radio station here, but the military started a radio station called KODK, and that was probably in 1940, shortly after the base was built. The Kodiak Island Hospital, or the Griffin Memorial Hospital, was built in 1940. The Baptist Church was built in 1940. The Baptist Mission was here when we got here, and it expanded gradually. It had nothing really to do directly with the war.
Now, was it on Woody Island at this time, or was it over on Kodiak?
It was being built in Kodiak on this side when we arrived.
Okay, you mentioned submarines and airplanes were based here. Where did they have the submarines stationed in relationship to our harbor today, and what kind of planes did they have here?
I'm not going to be able to give you much information on that. I don't know the types of planes or the types of ships that were in here. There were ships in here, and there were launches running back and forth to the ships. And there were submarines, I believe, moored out in Woman's Bay, at least that's where, one of the places I know that they were moored.
Yeah.
I want to step back just a minute and tell you what was here before the war, okay? Before the naval station. There were two stores, two bars, one church, one pool room, one cannery, as I already told you, Standard Oil Company, 101 Company, a post office, two cafes, one transfer company, dirt roads, cows in the streets, gardens in people's backyards, and the Baptist Mission. There was a U.S. commissioner, a U.S. marshal, a ramshackle jail with bed bugs, and no organized form of government. That was really about.
The Bays Town Road that we're familiar with today was that a dirt road at this time, or was it even constructed before the war?
That was constructed before the war. It was a single lane dirt road, and you can still see some remnants of it up on the side of Pillar Mountain. It ran along the edge of Pillar Mountain, about 100 feet up. And it's a single lane. There were a few places where if you met somebody, you were lucky you didn't have to back up too far to let them get by. That was there. It was a road out to Bell's Flats, Woman's Bay, where there was a ranch, or a couple of ranches. And it was there before the war. What wasn't here when we arrived? Automobiles. There were three. Ours was the third. Dave Street's electricity. It wasn't in. One light plant with two houses supplied by. No telephones, except for a crank system and it was a party system. No water system, no sewer system, no hospital, no laundry, no dry cleaners, no bakery, no airport, no boat harbor, no police force or any form of government. Also no dentist or veterinarian.
How did people get water?
From a well.
Was it a community well, or did everybody have their own well? Or?
There were several wells. There was a small water system called the Erskine system that came out of a dam in that cleft inside of Pillar Mountain that you see. There was a creek coming down there, and that was dammed and piped to a few houses. But there wasn't a water system for the whole community.
Dr. Johnson, what branches of the service seem to play a prominent role on Kodiak, and maybe you could tell me where they specifically were headquartered in relationship to town and Coast Guard base today?
Yeah, I think I can do that. In 1939, the surveyors came, and they had a building on Nyman's Peninsula, which projects into Woman's Bay. On the other side of the hangars, right? Where the administration building is now. And the officers are the Golden Hangar. Okay, that's on Nyman's Peninsula. Prior to that, actually, a couple of surveyors came up in 1938, a fellow by the name of Ed Carpenter and another fellow by the name of Steve Brody. And they had a tent on Nyman's Peninsula. And they were taking a preliminary look prior to the arrival. Surveyors. They called their camp, by the way, Whistle Britches. I think you can probably understand why. The wind blows out there. 1940, the Navy arrived. 3,500 officers and men. They were quartered in the area surrounding Woman's Bay. Okay? The head of Woman's Bay, Nyman's Peninsula, the whole area where the housing is surrounding the control tower for the airport was Navy housing. The area where the Coast Guard housing is now, a little circle of two-story houses where the commandant and the commanding officer lived, was where the naval commander lived. The same houses. There used to be quadruplexes there for naval officers, and there were barracks for the men. And up on so-called Aviation Hill, which is on the approach to the Coast Guard station entrance now, after you leave the airport and wind through the hills, there's housing there for Navy. Army was clustered around where the, what do they call that bunch of homes the Coast Guard people live in now, around Lake Louise?
Nimitz.
Nimitz. Uh-huh. Nimitz Park was a whole separate set of housing, including the hospital, Army barracks, and housing, and there was housing around Lake Louise as well. So the Army occupied that, and the Army occupied Tent Village and Tabuscan, down along the Tabuscan River. That's where they first settled in. A whole bivouac of tents, half frame and half tent, and little wood stoves or oil stoves, I don't remember. So Army Town was where the Coast Guard was, and Navy Town, or the Navy was where the hangars are and all the Coast Guard bases now. Is that pretty well answered? Marines were there too, but they were quartered in the area, clustered around the head of Woman's Bay and where the airport control tower and those houses are now.
What wartime personnel do you remember? And it doesn't have to be generals. It might be somebody that touched your family in a certain way. That might be a seaman.
I remember, yeah, you heard about all the generals and stuff. My folks were sort of social representatives of the community, and they always had the generals and the admirals in the beginning and vice versa. So Mom met a lot of them, including the four commanders in Alaska, the one in charge of the Air Force, the one in charge of the Navy, the one in charge of the Army, whom you heard me talking to her about.
Would you go ahead and mention those names for
sure,
people
I'll be
listening?
Sure, I don't know where I put that list. Yeah, okay. Simon Bolivar Buckner was quite a unique and charismatic character. He was in charge of the Army in Alaska. And he was subsequently killed by a grenade in a freak accident in the South Pacific somewhere, right after the war, which was too bad. General Butler was in charge of the Air Force in Alaska. General Corlett, I think, was in charge of the Army after Buckner. In charge of the Navy was an Admiral Kincaid. Those were all friends of my parents. Other names that come to mind that Mother used to talk about a lot was the chap who was in charge of the Kodiak Bear, which was the Naval Station newspaper, and his name was Roy Kraft. And he had a great sense of humor, which I think helped keep the morale of the Navy men up. They didn't have anything much to do. I think it's pretty hard to keep your morale up if you're sitting around somewhere a long way from home without your family and you don't feel like you're doing something useful. But he helped a lot in maintaining morale. And there was the Armed Forces Radio. The Rotary Club, as a matter of fact, financed the first radio, and the military took it over, and it was Armed Forces Radio. It was our only radio station for years. I think that started about 1940. Names of people who touched the family, there was a young Marine by the name of Danny Hogue. Came from the East Coast. Very enterprising young fellow that captured the heart of my parents, so he spent a lot of time out of the house. And he was one heck of an enterprising trader, and everything he traded or sold made a profit, and that impressed my dad very much. He was never very good at that sort of thing. And he thought this was really an enterprising young man. He subsequently did, I think, become quite well-to-do on the East Coast after he left the military. He was in the Marines here, spent a lot of time in our house, helped chop wood. We drank beer together. Took him swimming one day. We had a raft anchored off on a point in the ocean with a diving tower and a diving board. That might surprise you because people don't recreationally swim much in the ocean. And yeah, it was pretty perky and was willing to take a dip in the ocean. We didn't swim in a leisurely fashion. Dive in, get out in a hurry, dive in, get out in a hurry. One day, I'll never forget, he brought a friend of his who was a Southerner, a Marine. Slow talking, you know, drawl. And Dan and I said, "Hey, how'd you like to go swimming?" "Oh, you swim up here?" "Sure." "Okay," he said. So we got in a little skiff and rowed out to where we had the anchor, put on our suits. Got in the skiff, nice warm sunny day, like we rowed out to the raft, pretty good sized raft. And Danny and I knew what was going to happen here. He hadn't put his finger in the water, he didn't know. And so I ran out to the end of the board, dove in, made a very great effort not to blow my breath out and puff and huff when I came up, you know. Swam back leisurely to the raft. Danny did the same thing. And that took some doing, because you tend to lose your breath the moment you hit that water. It's in the low 50s. This fellow came out to the end and jumped off the board, and he almost came out of the water before he went in. I've never seen anybody surface so fast, and came back to the raft panting and gasping for breath. We had a wonderful laugh out of that. It wasn't very kind to the guy, but, you know, how it is. Anyway, that was some of the adventures with some of the servicemen here. I don't remember any others. I think there was a Navy man or two who came up to the house. My folks kind of adopted and treated them like parents, which was nice. Drew them all away from home. Who else? Well, you heard me talking to Mom about a USO. There was a fellow by the name of Howard Demarest who came up here and set up the USO in an apartment building with my folks. eventually owned. They didn't at the time. And a lot of people came through here in the entertainment business to perform for the troops. I don't remember all of them, but I remember Joey Brown. I remember Errol Flynn, who my mother said was not worthy of listening to us. Well, I won't tell you. She didn't think he was very ethical or very moral. We thought his music was pretty base. Errol Flynn was one of my heroes, and it was hard to hear that kind of thing about him. He was a rough and tumble, swashbuckling pirate most of the time. But USO had dances for the guys, and all the local women turned out and danced with the military, the boys, the soldiers, and the sailors. And they had square dances. The little town did its best to be a good host to the military. There were 12,000 troops at one time, I had down in my notes. That's army. And 3,000 to 3,500 naval personnel, officers. So that swelled our population by about 15,500 in addition to the growing town. We probably had 26,500, which is a figure that I pulled out of my notes for the early 40s.
Dr. Johnson, my next question is, what kind of effect did the war have on how your family made a living, or how they conducted their living, or the citizens of Kodiak? And I guess what I'm asking here is, can you tell me anything? Did they go through the rationing system that we did back in Wisconsin, or blackout drills? What kind of situation were they in?
Okay. We, as soon as Dutch Harbor was bombed, Kodiak went on blackout. Dutch Harbor was bombed in, let's see, 42, June 42. And then we went into blackouts, and that meant that every window had to have a framed opaque inner shield, so no light would escape from the house. So Kodiak was blacked out totally. Automobiles could drive with a little slit in the headlights. There weren't many automobiles, or there were more, of course, as time went along. I remember my dad going out on calls in the blackout with his car and not using any lights, driving by the silhouettes of the trees and the houses. He didn't always manage to stay on the road. One night, particularly, he went off the road and he didn't get back on. But that was interesting. I can remember going out of the back of the house and trying to find my way downtown to go to the movie in the pitch black. I didn't use flashlights either unless they were covered with red paper. And we kind of got pretty good at being able to hear obstacles. There were trees in the yard. And if you've ever moved around in the dark in a fairly familiar place, you know you can feel some kind of sound wave come back, or some kind of wave come back from an object when you get close to it. You can get pretty good at reading that. But yes, we did have blackouts every night. And let me see. There's some quotes from the mirror. January 17, 1942. A new order has been issued by military authorities that henceforth the masking of lights must be done with red instead of blue cellophane. Red flashlights appeared in great numbers last night, and stores are having a run on the new color. That was in Kodiak. We did have a civil defense force. The civilian community was organized, and I forgot my Aunt W.J. Erskine was in charge of that. I know that I was to be a messenger boy in case there were any hostilities. I got to drive a little empty car that Mrs. Erskine owned, and I could hardly wait for hostilities to break out, but they never did. So I could drive the car.
Yeah.
How did it affect us other than the blackouts? Well, not much, really. Life went on pretty much as usual, except for our town was burgeoning. Just to give you an idea, I did have here right in front of me just a minute ago. You remember I just read off for you what we had in town when we got here? I just came across what we had in town a few minutes ago. There it is. In 1943. Okay. I'll do that in a minute, but I wanted to tell you one other thing. Here's an interesting quote that tells you something about the plight of the military man, Kodiak. This is taken out of the mirror, May 23, 1942. And it's written by, as you can tell, a soldier. Quote, "I am a soldier. In town the other day I met a sailor. The two of us agreed on several things. We didn't care to visit the ladies of easy virtue. We didn't care to sit and drink all day. A drink or two would not be bad, but what to do after that? We walked out past Al's Chicken Inn. Next time we'll walk out the other road. Then what?" Unquote. There wasn't much to do in Kodiak for somebody who was used to living somewhere else. For us in Kodiak, there was skating, there was hiking, there was hunting, there was a lot to do, we thought. But for somebody who was used to organized activity outside, there wasn't much to do, and it was a lot of main service. Here in 1943, after 4 years of growth, that was the result of the naval station, we had 8 bars, several restaurants, 2 churches, hospital, up to 12-bed hospital, Griffin Memorial, which is now the Mental Health Center, 3 transfer companies, an ice cream parlor, 2 liquor stores, a movie theater, Armed Forces Radio, 2 drugstores, a cab company, a phone system, a community water supply, an electric association, KEA, a police force, a city government, mayor and council, and a bank. We had 41 businesses listed in the Korean Union. We had a population of 25,600, including the military. That tells you something about the growth. Now where were we?
What kind of changes did you see happening to people that were living in the villages outside of Kodiak? And I'm thinking of the natives especially. Were they affected to any degree, or did life kind of go on the same for them?
As far as I know, the villages weren't really touched much by the military. I suppose when they came to town, it was a little wilder than it was when they came to town before. But they spent a lot of time in the villages and didn't spend a lot of time in town, except occasionally. So I'm not sure. I don't think it affected them too much. Oh, there's one other thing I forgot. There was a newspaper in town in the 1940s. I didn't list that among the things I just mentioned. That began in 1940. And the guy that started it was Gene Dawson. It came out as a weekly, and it was in the past, 16 pages in the past. It was one of the printers that started. Okay. I don't think the villages were much affected by the war. I don't know whether they had blackouts or not. Oh, an interesting other thing that happened that I know about. There's a little village, a pseudo-village, a fake village, on the other side of the naval station, where Holiday Beach is now. You know where that is? Okay. They had a simulated village with a lot of boxes and lights in them, and we turned out all of our lights at night. A blackout, of course, it's over the naval station. And that little village would go on at night. In case anybody came around and was dropping any bombs, people should drop them. They dropped them there. Nobody ever came around and dropped anything, as you know, but we had a few unidentified planes fly over, and we had moments of excitement. All the closer the war got, less than Korea. Ah, you did ask about rations.
Yeah.
No such thing in Korea. There never has been rationing in Korea. There never has been a problem here that has reflected the same problems that you've had in the South 48, or continental United States. We are too, of course, but I think some people still think we're a foreign country. They still write and ask for a sample of our currency, as a matter of fact. Did you know that?
No.
Once in a while, not very often. It used to be all the time. But we were encouraged to hoard. we were encouraged to buy a large supply of canned goods and store them because we felt we might be cut off from our source of supply. And they wanted us to have some supply on hand, some food on hand, some clothing on hand. So we were encouraged to hoard. And there was never any shortage here. But we didn't have any gasoline rations. We didn't have any kind of rations.
Yeah. Dr. Bob, I know that there have been a lot of changes to Kodiak since the time you described that sleepy town with basically a seasonal occupation with salmon. I know the fishing industry has changed just a whole lot since then and has been through different kind of stages. But what do you think, what kind of lasting effect has World War II brought to Kodiak? Do you see any long-term effects that the war caused outside of, you know, I'm not looking for changes in the fishing industry. I don't think probably the war caused that, but any other changes you pick up?
I wouldn't have attributed the growth of the community to the war. It began to grow then, and it had a big spurt then. It would have grown anyway, and it would have grown to the same size it has now. It would have started, it would have developed more slowly. But the same natural resources, the same fisheries have been present all along, and they would have been discovered and developed. So the war, I think, didn't really influence us much, except it did get the city incorporated, and it did get an organized government going, and it did give us the structure that facilitated the subsequent growth. That would have come in time, too, so I don't really think that looking at the long-term situation, our growth was based on our natural resources and not on the war. There are a couple of things, though, that were influenced by that. We know about Fort Abercrombie. Fort Abercrombie is being developed as a historic site, and it's a historic site because of the role it played in the war. There was army deployed out there. In fact, I forgot to mention, there was army deployed all over the place on various points, manning various guns and lookout stations. Long Island had a big contingent of army. Chiniac did. Abercrombie did. Miller Point did. And they had lookout towers and guns, presumably to guard the harbor against enemy ships. But Abercrombie has become a, at least it's being developed or being, trying to develop it under the Park Service as a historic monument to World War II, or the Aleutian War. And they've done quite a bit of that. So that, in a sense, has contributed to Kodiak. It has created some history that we are now using for a tourist attraction and for our own enrichment. That's one thing. I can think of another spin-off that benefited us personally and a number of people. All those army buildings in the village that is now USA Homes, what did you call it? Nimitz Park?
Nimitz Park, yeah.
All the army buildings there were built out of grade one fir, and they were all demolished by local contractors, and the lumber was sold. And we bought all the lumber that went into this house, the basic framing of this house, at $60 a thousand, and it was grade one fir, which is the best you can get. And lumber was never cheaper and never more available than it was at that time, and it helped us build a lot of things at less cost. I suppose they would have been built later, but that was a boost. Now, quite a few service people, quite a few people from the army met and married and stayed in Kodiak. Ole Johnson, who recently died, was president of the Chamber of Commerce, mayor of the city of Kodiak, and manager of Kodiak Electric Association for many, many years, came to us through the army. And a number of other residents did, and then Navy boys decided they wanted to stay in Kodiak. So the war and the military occupation of the naval, the army camp and the naval station contributed to our population directly. Okay, I can't tell you numbers, but there are quite a few, both Navy and Army people, and some Marines who were here, and civil service workers who came up and used their home and stayed afterwards and retired here. So it contributed to us in that way. But Kodiak wouldn't be much different, with the exception of the absence of Fort Abercrombie and a certain number of our residents. Were there no war or no devastation?
Okay, thank you, Dr. Bapa. Before we close, I'd like you to have any opportunity you want here to share anything else you think is kind of important when we think back to those years. And I know that's kind of a real open question, but if there's something else that you can think of that would be interesting to us, we sure have some minutes to share it here.
I've never thought of that question. I've never thought of the war as anything more than a little item of history that went in Kodiak. I haven't sat down and analyzed its influence on us as a community, except tonight. And I've already told you that I thought it didn't really influence us a great deal as a community, and I thought we would be about where we are now, even if it were not for the war. But there were a lot of little things, and I just remembered a few more. The Army built a lot of roads, and it's driven around the backwoods and gone out to the base, and explored a bit in your car. You find a lot of them are still passable. We built the road from the Coppola Mountain all the way out to join the road that cuts back in on the way out to the airport. That road was passable just a few years ago.
By Swampy Acres?
Swampy Acres, a windy valley, we used to call it. Swampy Acres, I think is what you call it. Yeah, it goes down in the Swampy Acres and back to the mountain. And you could drive that with a four-wheel vehicle up until just a few years ago. They built a road behind Old Woman's Mountain back over into Bell's Flats from the airport. You got that. And there are roads all over there. They built the road that you just rode in. The Army built that road in here. This was a searchlight site right here, and it was a submarine net that came here in Woody Island. I'd forgotten about that. And the submarine net, of course, isn't there anymore, but the road is still there.
Yeah.
And there are roads, I'm sure, that people are using that were built by them. I'd forgotten that. But these are things that probably would have been done anyway. So I don't see how the war affected us much differently than it affected anybody else. Wars are devastating. People are killed and people are lost, and some of our people were in the service and some of our people were lost, and that happens. I'm not sure that more people are killed in the war than are in accidents in peacetime or by their own hand or from illness or what have you. So that may not be a pertinent argument. So I guess in summary I say I don't see that the war had a great deal of effect on Kodiak, as I started with the same premise, that we would probably be pretty much the same now as we are, whether we had a war, whether we had a naval station, whether we had an army in here or not, with the exception of a number of people that live here that stayed.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Bob Johnson, and for spending your time with us this evening and giving us this information that we hope to include in a oral history project.
It would have been very, very if you didn't have a chance to.